In the quiet lanes of folded strand, a hidden rhythm slips from hand to hand.
Welcome to Bass by Bass, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app. So how could a tiny editing error, I mean, one that affects less than 0.5% of our genetic instructions, cascade into a completely devastating multi-system disease?
Yeah, that's the real question here.
Right, like, what actually happens when the microscopic machinery that's responsible for the most highly specialized cuts in our DNA just starts to break down, leaving patients with these really severe symptoms, but, you know, zero diagnosis?
We're basically looking at a scenario where the fundamental rule book of how a cell processes information gets altered. And it happens in incredibly subtle, but just profoundly damaging ways.
Right.
And honestly, to solve a biological mystery of this scale, bridging that gap between a seemingly invisible genetic variant and a catastrophic clinical presentation, it requires an almost unprecedented level of collaboration.
Which is exactly the mission of today's deep dive. We are examining this groundbreaking genomic and transcriptomic study that actually solves a medical mystery for three unrelated individuals by identifying a brand new genetic disease. So today we celebrate the work of the Undiagnosed Diseases Network, the Gregor Consortium, Stanford University, and the Broad Institute, who have really advanced our understanding of minor spliceopathies.
Yeah, their work is just incredible. It highlights an area of cellular biology that, honestly, it often gets totally overshadowed.
Because everyone focuses on the major one, right?
Exactly. The major spliceosome handles the vast bulk of our transcriptome. But here, we are focusing on that crucial 0.5%, the U12 type introns.
Okay, so just to put some numbers to that, there are only about, 770 of these specific introns scattered across the human genome.
Yeah, roughly 770. But the catch is, they are disproportionately located in genes that regulate really important stuff, like the cell cycle, DNA repair, and information processing.
Okay, let's unpack this with a structural analogy. I'm thinking of it kind of like film editing. So the major spliceosome is the main editing bay, right? Handling 99.5% of the standard cuts for the movie.
Right, the bulk of the work.
But then there's a smaller, highly specialized bay, the minor spliceosome, that only processes the remaining 0.5%. But those specific scenes are absolutely critical to the actual plot of the movie. If you mess them up, the whole movie makes no sense.
That's a great way to look at it. And that specialized bay relies on very specific, delicate equipment. So the minor spliceosome is built from 5 small nuclear RNAs, or snRNAs.
And those are, wait, let me guess, U11, U12?
Yep, U11, U12, U4TAC, U6TAC, and U5. But for the minor spliceosome to actually become catalytically active, you know, to make its cut, 2 of these molecules, specifically U4TAC and U6TAC, have to undergo this highly complex structural interaction.
I imagine this is less like puzzle pieces just snapping together and more like, I don't know, a complex magnetic docking sequence between 2 spacecraft in orbit.
Yeah, that is a highly accurate way to visualize it, actually. These 2 non-coding RNA molecules have to hybridize perfectly. They base pair to form these complex secondary structures known as the STEM-I and STEM-II regions.
Yeah.
And if those specific base pairs are even slightly misaligned by a genetic variant, well, the magnetic docking fails.
The spacecraft just bounce off each other.
Exactly. They bounce off, the catalytic core never forms, and the specialized editing process just grinds to a halt.
So if the docking fails, those specialized sequences, those 770 minor introns, they're simply left inside the mature messenger RNA.
Yes, and we refer to that biological failure as minor intron retention.
Which sounds bad.
It is, and we actually already have a robust clinical framework for what happens when this mechanism fails. Like, genetic defects in the U4TAC component cause severe developmental disorders. We call them RNU4TACopathies.
Oh, right, like Reitman syndrome or MOPD1 syndrome. Those manifest with the severe short stature, microcephaly, immunodeficiency, stuff like that.
Precisely. We understand the fallout when the U4TAC side of the docking mechanism is broken, but the missing variable driving this new research was this specific group of patients.
Yeah, the same symptoms, right?
Exactly the same severe multi-system phenotypes, but their RNU4ATAC genes were completely wild type, perfectly normal.
Wow, so the clinical teams were looking right at the usual suspect, and its sequence was just flawless.
Right. And in a diagnostic setting, encountering a textbook minor splicopathy phenotype with a negative standard genetic test, it forces you to rethink your entire approach.
You have to pivot.
You do. The standard genetic tests were coming back negative, so the research team realized they could not rely on standard genomic panel sequencing anymore. They had to look at the functional output of the cells, you know, the entire transcriptome, to find the invisible error.
Wait, okay, hold on. If these minor introns represent less than 0.5% of the genome, how do you mathematically isolate the error? I mean, if you look at an entire transcriptome, wouldn't the signal of minor intron retention just get completely drowned out by the background noise of major spliceosome errors?
Historically, yes. That signal-to-noise ratio has been the primary bottleneck in computational transcriptomics for years.
Because there's just too much data.
Exactly. If an algorithm simply looks for all retained introns across the whole genome, the sheer volume of normal stochastic splicing errors from the major spliceosome just completely buries the minor spliceosome signal. But the researchers solved this by adapting an existing analytical tool called Fraser.
Oh, I'm assuming Fraser relies on some specific filtering logic to kind of cut through that noise.
It does. Rather than applying a blanket analysis, they strictly constrained the algorithm. They forced Fraser to look exclusively for minor intron retention, or MR.
Oh, so they just ignored the rest.
Yep, they programmed it to ignore the 99.5% of major introns. It specifically quantified retention events only within U12 type minor introns. And by applying this refined bioinformatic filter across a massive dataset, we're talking 385 whole blood samples and 139 fibroblast samples, the statistical noise just evaporated.
Wow. So you don't even need to amplify a weak signal if you can just mathematically mute the background interference.
Exactly.
But there is another massive diagnostic gap here that we really have to talk about. The researchers had to utilize whole genome sequencing, or WGS, for these patients. And the underlying reason why is something that should give, like, every geneticist pause.
It really should.
Standard whole exome sequencing kits, the WES panels that diagnostic labs use every single day to hunt for rare diseases, they literally do not target the RNU6ATAC gene.
It represents a profound systemic blind spot in modern diagnostics. If you are looking at a standard WES panel in your lab right now, you might assume you have covered all the necessary bases for complex developmental disorders.
Right, you'd think you're being thorough.
But whole exome sequencing is fundamentally designed to capture the protein coding regions of the genome. And RNU6ATAC is a non-coding RNA. It never translates into a protein. It folds into the cellular machinery that edits the instructions for other proteins.
So because it lacks those standard exonic translation signals, it is entirely omitted from the physical capture probes used in the WES kits.
Exactly.
It's like trying to figure out why a factory assembly line is broken by exclusively reading the blueprints for the final product while completely ignoring the blueprints for the robotic arms that are actually building the product.
That's a perfect analogy.
The product instructions are fine, the robotic arm is broken, but your diagnostic tools are literally incapable of perceiving the robotic arm.
And by transitioning to whole genome sequencing and pairing it with that highly constrained transcriptomic filter, the team finally circumvented that structural blind spot. They identified three unrelated individuals who all carried rare biallelic variants, meaning mutations on both alleles, of the RNU6ATAC gene.
We finally located the structural damage to the other side of the docking mechanism.
We did, and the computational predictions for these variants indicate severe structural disruption. In computational genetics, we use the CADIS score to predict the deleteriousness of a variant.
Right.
For non-coding RNAs, a CADIS score above 11.44 is the accepted threshold for high suspicion.
Okay, so where did these patients score?
All the RNU6ATAC variants identified in these three individuals presented with CAD scores between 18 and 21.
Oh, wow. That's extremely high.
Extremely. Furthermore, these specific genomic coordinates are highly conserved across vertebrate evolution, all the way down to zebrafish.
Let's contextualize that for the listener for a second. Zebrafish and humans diverged from a common ancestor roughly 400 million years ago.
Right.
If a sequence of non-coding RNA has remained virtually unchanged through 400 million years of evolutionary pressure, plus multiple mass extinctions, it dictates a biological function so foundational that any deviation is just incompatible with optimal cellular survival.
That evolutionary conservation completely explains the severity of the clinical phenotypes we see in these individuals. Let's examine the first patient, individual A1.
Okay.
This was a 14-year-old female in the Discovery cohort, analyzed via whole blood transcriptomics. Her RNA sequencing profile was not merely abnormal, it represented a massive functional collapse of the minor spliceosome.
Yeah, the paper notes she had an unprecedented transcriptomic signal.
To contextualize the scale of this disruption, the average number of minor intron retention events in the unaffected control cohort was 0.1.
0.1, okay.
Individual A1 presented with 254 minor intron retention errors across 142 different genes. Her statistical Z-score was 7.7. The minor spliceosome in her hematopoietic system was effectively non-functional.
That is staggering. And her clinical presentation mirrors that catastrophic cellular failure, heavily weighted toward neurodevelopment. I mean, her medical history included microcephaly, refractory epilepsy, so seizures entirely resistant to pharmacological intervention, ataxia, autism, severe short stature, and a condition known as hyperuricinophilia.
Right, and hyperuricinophilia indicates an abnormally high proliferation of a specific eosinophilic white blood cell, which points to underlying immune dysregulation. But her primary physiological burden was undeniably neurodevelopmental.
Right.
Now, we must contrast that presentation with individual B1. He was a 30-year-old male, also within the Discovery cohort, but his transcriptomic data was derived from fibroblast cells.
And his data also generated a massive outlier signal, right? He presented with a Z-score of 10.4, logging 16 minor intron retention events across 14 genes. But when you look at his clinical chart, the presentation is entirely distinct from A1.
The clinical divergence is remarkable. Individual B1 exhibited absolutely zero neurodevelopmental pathology.
None.
None. He had no microcephaly, no epilepsy, and entirely normal cognitive function. His physiological burden was heavily systemic and immune-centric. He suffered from failure to thrive, primary hypothyroidism, a severe immunodeficiency that clinically mirrored common variable immunodeficiency, or CVID, universal alopecia, and chronic inflammatory demyelinating polyneuropathy.
Honestly, if you were an attending physician looking at these two medical charts, you were looking at two entirely disparate disease states. One pathology is actively deteriorating the central nervous system and skeletal growth, while the other is systematically dismantling the immune and endocrine systems. There is no immediate clinical logic that would link these presentations to a mutation in the exact same non-coding RNA gene.
Which is exactly why the discovery of individual C1 during the replication phase of the study provides the necessary biological synthesis.
The missing link.
Exactly. C1 was a 17-year-old male who represents a classic bridging phenotype.
He's the functional link between the two clinical extremes.
Yes. Individual C1 carried a homozygous variant, so the exact same mutation on both paternal and maternal alleles, that directly disrupts the crucial STEM2 region.
And that's the exact site where U4ATAC and U6ATAC are thermodynamically required to bind.
Precisely. Clinically, he exhibited the neurodevelopmental pathology of A1, including the microcephaly and severe growth failure, while simultaneously suffering from the profound immune and systemic issues of B1, including the immunodeficiency, skeletal dysplasia, and early onset type 1 diabetes.
So C1 really demonstrates that we are not observing two separate diseases here. We're observing a single, highly variable clinical spectrum.
Right.
Depending on the specific mutation, the failure of the RNU6ATAC gene can systematically dismantle the brain, the immune system, the skeleton, or the endocrine system.
Because the minor spliceosome is a universally required component in the cells comprising all of those tissues. However, this clinical variability introduces a really profound question about cellular kinetics and tissue-specific biology.
Right, and here's where it gets really interesting. A1 exhibited 254 retention errors in her blood transcriptome, while B1 exhibited only 16 errors in his fibroblast transcriptome.
Mm.
So is this purely a function of their specific genetic variants carrying different structural penalties? Or is there an underlying biological difference in how blood cells and skin cells actually utilize the minor spliceosome?
We have to look at tissue-specific biological sensitivity, specifically regarding cellular turnover rates. Hematopoietic cells, the blood cells analyzed in A1, are characterized by incredibly rapid division.
Because they're constantly regenerating.
Exactly, to maintain immune and oxygen-carrying homeostasis. To sustain that aggressive kinetic pace, they require a massive functional reserve of the minor spliceosome. They need that highly specialized splicing machinery operating at maximum theoretical capacity at all times to ensure rapid cellular maturation.
It's akin to a high-volume restaurant kitchen during a dinner rush. The turnover is so aggressive that if even a single specialized chef is operating at reduced capacity, the entire assembly line backs up and the structural integrity of the service just collapses.
Exactly. Conversely, fibroblasts, the connective tissue cells analyzed in B1, divide at a significantly reduced rate.
So less pressure on the kitchen.
Exactly. Their metabolic demands are lower. They can likely maintain homeostasis with a much lower baseline of minor spliceosome function. It's a much slower kitchen. Therefore, a genetic variant that completely depletes the functional reserve in fast-dividing hematopoietic cells, causing a massive backup of unspliced transcripts, might only register as a minor operational hiccup in the slow-dividing fibroblasts.
Wow, okay. I see how the cellular kinetics dictate the transcriptomic fallout. A1-specific variants, which disrupted both the STEM-I and STEM-II structural regions, likely eradicated that functional reserve entirely in her fast-dividing blood lineage, which resulted in the 254 splicing failures. Right. But B1's variants were located at the stem and stem testa boundary and the central stem loop. That specific structural penalty might have allowed his slower dividing fibroblasts to scrape by with a minimal 16 errors. It perfectly illustrates how microscopic thermodynamics dictate macroscopic human disease.
It really does. And the clinical implications of mapping this biological mechanism are immediate. This study definitively establishes RNU6-ATAC as a novel disease-causing gene. It structurally proves that these vastly divergent clinical presentations, from the severe neurological deficits of A1 to the profound immune failure of B1, are distinct endpoints on a continuous spectrum of a minor spliceopathy.
So what does this all mean for the diagnostic landscape moving forward? I mean, we know this research provides long-awaited closure and a definitive molecular answer for these three families, but how does this alter the approach of the broader genomic community?
The scientific community must aggressively identify additional patients to map these genotype-phenotype correlations with high resolution. We need to determine exactly which structural disruptions the snRNA molecule trigger, which specific clinical outcomes on that spectrum.
Right.
But the most critical operational change must happen within clinical bioinformatics pipelines. Diagnostic laboratories must start incorporating targeted transcriptomic filtering for U12 type minor introns. We cannot continue to overlook these debilitating diagnoses simply because the algorithm is overwhelmed by the background noise of the major spliceosome.
Yeah, if you are building diagnostic pipelines today, you have to transition away from a strictly exome-centric view and deploy functional transcriptomic filters. You need those algorithmic noise-canceling headphones universally applied in diagnostic settings. So give us the final rundown.
By combining targeted transcriptomic filtering with whole genome sequencing, this research reveals that variants in the RNU6-ATAC gene cause a distinct multisystem minor spliceopathy. This discovery not only solves a medical mystery for these families, but fundamentally expands our understanding of how crucial the non-coding regions of our genome are to human development and immunity.
It really fundamentally challenges our historical assumptions about the genome, and it leaves you wondering, what does this mean for the vast expanses of non-coding RNA that we previously dismissed as junk DNA? Could subtle overlooked variations in other auxiliary spliceosome components be the hidden drivers behind the complex, everyday autoimmune and developmental diseases we see across the general population?
It's a huge question. The deeper we look into the non-coding architecture, the more we realize that the sequences we once ignored are actually dictating the operational parameters of the entire cellular machine.
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.
In the quiet lanes of photo strand, a hidden rhythm slips from hand to hand. Little doors in a message don't close on time, and the whole wide chorus falls out of line. We trace the tremor through the script tonight, from the smallest splice to the body's fight. Tiny changes and the gears misfire. Hear that heartbeat. wonder why. Turn on the minor intro lights. Let the small cuts make sense of night. When the words get stuck, we read them through. Find the break, find the thread, find you. Short horizon, bones and breath. Signals tangled in the shade of health. Blood and skin cells, the same refrain. A subtle fault with the widespread pain. Not every clue is loud and clear. Some are whispers you can only hear. When you line up the reads, let patterns speak and follow.